testimony you're about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God.
I do.
Please be seated.
Commander Rome, before we start questioning you, Mr. Howitt wanted to make a clarification on a statement he made or question in an answer in response to a question when he was on a witness stand. Mr. Howitt?
Yes, that's correct. Mr. Colucciello asked me about the approval of the Prince William Sound plan. I wanted to make a clarification that DOI has approved, or one branch of the DOI has approved the entire plan from beginning of startup through 1988. In particular, the Alaska Pipeline Office of the DOI approved the entire plan in 1977, 78, and 79. And beginning in 1980, the BLM took over that review of the oil spill contingency plan and continues through now to approve the entire plan in all its volumes.
So you're saying there is a federal agency that approves the plans in Prince William Sound as well as land spills?
That's correct.
Both?
That's correct.
Thank you. Sorry, Commander Rome.
Sir, would you state your rank, full name?
My name is Commander Dennis D. Rome.
And what is your assignment?
Currently, I'm assigned as the Chief of the Environmental Protection Branch for the 17th Coast Guard District in Juneau, Alaska.
And how long have you been in this position?
I've been in this position since August 1987.
Okay. Mr. Kacharian will ask you some more questions.
Do you have any previous experience in pollution response?
Starting in 1987, I was assigned to the Office of Research and Development and Coast Guard Headquarters in the Environmental Technology Branch, in which we worked on R&D projects in oil and chemical spill response. And I served in the R&D field from 1977 to 1982. And in 1982, I was assigned to the Pacific Strike Team as the Executive Officer. In 1983, I stayed on the Pacific Strike Team as the Commanding Officer until 1987.
Okay. Can you describe Coast Guard responsibilities for oil response when the spiller assumes responsibility for the cleanup?
When a spiller assumes responsibility for a cleanup, the Coast Guard's role is to monitor the cleanup, to evaluate whether the spiller is taking appropriate action in the opinion of the Federal On-Scene Coordinator, and in those circumstances where the Federal On-Scene Coordinator feels that the response is inadequate or other steps could be taken, the Federal On-Scene Coordinator may activate the pollution fund and use federal resources and or other commercial resources.
Now there's a national contingency plan and a regional contingency plan. What are the purposes of the teams, the national response team and the regional response team in a spill incident?
The national response team is in Washington, D.C., and the makeup of the National Response Team is primarily federal agencies, and they establish the policy for how environmental response on a federal level should be done. And they disseminate that policy through the National Contingency Plan. And the regional contingency plan, and these regional contingency plans are set up by federal region, and the boundaries are set up by the federal regional boundaries. There are three special circumstances to that. One is in the Caribbean, the other is in Hawaii and Oceania, Guam, and the third is in the state of Alaska that have separate standing regional response teams. And within the Alaska region, we are required to have a regional contingency plan, oil and hazardous substance contingency plan.
In this incident, what would have been Exxon's financial responsibility for the spill if it decided, after it initially did some cleanup work, to turn it over to the Coast Guard, or the Coast Guard decided that they weren't doing their job?
That's a difficult question to ask because, or to answer, actually. There's a number of liability regimes that are being investigated now in terms of one possible one is the limit of liability regime that is involved with the Trans-Alaska Pipeline Act, in which the spiller is responsible essentially for the first $14 million spent in the cleanup, and then the next $86 million up to $100 million limit of liability would be borne by the Trans-Alaska Pipeline Fund. There are other liability regimes that are being investigated that may change that, so I don't have an answer for what the ultimate liability of Exxon would be on this spill.
On the federal level, is there a dollar value per ton of vessel that the company is responsible for?
Under the Federal Water Pollution Control Act, the limit of liability was established at $150 per gross ton.
Do you have any recent example of where a vessel refused or failed or was unable to do a cleanup?
There have been two or three instances on the Aleutian chain where we have a foreign fish processor that has run aground. Their gross tonnage is approximately 2,000 gross tons to 3,000 gross tons. Their limit of liability or exposure is $300,000 to $400,000. In order to mount a response in the Aleutian chain, your rough estimates are looking anywhere from $400,000 to $1 million, depending on what you're going to do. And it's been an activity taken by the spiller where they've said, you know, we choose not to respond. And the Coast Guard has assumed responsibility for conducting the cleanup.
Now, in your role is in the district, what do you do when a captain of a port or a federal on-scene coordinator calls? Are you an advisor? Or?
In my duties, in my current position, I'm the alternate co-chair of the regional response team in the event that my boss, Captain Haynes, who's the co-chair, is not there. Essentially, I would receive the call from the federal on-scene coordinator, get as much information as I can from him, and find out the severity of the spill, the circumstances of what's going on, some of the operational details. I'll ask questions on what resources has he activated. Does he have a spiller that's been identified, and is a spiller assuming responsibility? And give him an opportunity to go ahead and go out and do a good assessment and make sure that he makes the notifications that he needs to make.
Are drills required annually with the RRT and Coast Guard environment to keep them current? Or?
Within the standard operating procedure that we have within the 17th Coast Guard districts, the Marine Safety Offices are required to have an annual drill or an annual activation of their local contingency plan and demonstrate that they, first of all, know the plan, exercise what equipment that they may have, which is normally limited in terms of actual cleanup equipment. And you know, they're essentially critiqued by either myself or my staff. What we have done in the past, since I've been on the job in 1987, we had an OSC RRT exercise, which is a tabletop exercise involving a couple of one scenario in Southeast Alaska, and then in May of 1988 there was a scenario involving another involving a ship up in the Chukchi Sea, and it's a full-blown RRT on-scene coordinator exercise, and all three MSOs have been able to participate. So it gave them training in the regional contingency plan, in each of the local contingency plans that the other OCMIs have.
Well, do the local Coast Guard on-scene coordinators, do they stockpile response equipment?
Normally, very little. We look at in the 17th district, most of our spill response activity involves small boat sinking in boat harbors where you have a limited quantity of either gasoline or diesel, and it's a sorbent pad small boom type cleanup, and that's the majority of our activity. And we have pre-staged strike team equipment, the skimming barrier, complete skimming barrier system, and some lightering pumps in Anchorage that we flew and stored in Anchorage in October of 1987.
What is the purpose of calling the OSC's purpose in calling the RRT?
In a major spill or a potential major spill, the regional response team is automatically activated. That's a provision of the National Contingency Plan. That means that there are some notification requirements that need to be done. Anything, it's a district policy that anything above a minor spill, which is less than about 500 gallons, as we have for a policy, that they shall notify the district, specifically me, or if I'm not there, my assistant.
Now, is it true that the RRT is basically an advisory group to the on-scene coordinator?
The RRT is an advisory group to the federal on-scene coordinator.
The final decisions, anything being done in the cleanup area, then that's up to the OSC then.
There are two distinct circumstances where the regional response team has approval authority. The first is in the use of dispersants or chemical additives, biological additives, and the second is in the in in-situ burning. And primarily in the in-situ burning, the lead agency is, in terms of that approval, is the Department of Environmental Conservation. They issue a burning permit.
Does the RRT attempt to come to a consensus of opinion when they advise the OSC?
Yes.
Can you describe your first 24 hours involvement in this accident?
I was first notified that the Exxon Valdez had run aground at approximately 0050, 10 minutes, 5 minutes, the one by Lieutenant Commander Falkenstein, who's the executive officer on at Marine Safety Office Valdez. And he notified that the tanker had run aground, and his best report, they were leaking oil, unknown quantity at the time of how much oil had leaked out. And I asked him a series of questions. Have you notified the National Strike Force? It's been my experience that when a tanker runs aground, all the tanks aren't affected. And I said they've got plenty of ADAPS equipment that they can go ahead and launch out. If you need to push the button on that. And the skimming barrier system was in Anchorage. And if you feel you need to pre-stage that, we can take whatever steps we need necessary to pre-stage that. Have you notified DEC? Have you notified the trustees of the natural resources, which would be the Department of Interior and Department of Commerce? And then I told him I'd go ahead and call Captain Haynes and Captain Haynes and my associate, Lieutenant Carey, and then Captain Haynes called the Admiral. And what had happened was, the notifications through each of the agencies were being made at the same time. So at approximately 0600, he started calling the agencies to tell them that we were scheduling an RRT meeting at 10 o'clock, and that the primary issues were to get an update of what was happening, the best intelligence that the Marine Safety Office had at the time on the condition of the vessel, how much oil had been spilled, operational details, and also to consider, certainly be ready to discuss the use of dispersants, both corrects at 9527 and corrects at 9550, and also to discuss in-situ burning. At At 11:30, we actually held the RRT meeting. We had some technical difficulties with telephones and getting everybody in. But at that time, at 11:30 in the morning, Commander McCall had a pretty good feel for how much oil had been spilled. By 8:30 in the morning, we had received a telefax of a dispersant application from Alyeska for the application 9527. And
was that a request?
That was a request, yes. It was a completed dispersant use checklist that the RRT has come to adopt, I think, over the last 9 months or so. And during the RRT meeting itself, Commander McCall gave us an update of the operational situation, indicated which tanks that he knew at the time had been breached, an estimate in the order of 250,000 barrels that he believed had been lost. And he talked about the, as best I remember, that the equipment that Alyeska was committing, whatever resources they had to go out there and as a response to the spill. And then we discussed the dispersants issue.
Anything else discussed at the meeting?
At the meeting, we gave the on-scene coordinator the location of the spill, or the location of the ship, was in a zone 2. This zone 2 under the dispersant use guidelines was that the actual location was in an area that was not pre-approved for the OSC for the use of dispersants. And we were given some indication that the leading edge of the slick had gone into a zone 1. And we had the discussion with the OSC that is in a pre-approval zone. And you have the authority to, as an operational decision, to use dispersants if you think it's appropriate.
Who establishes those guidelines for the dispersant?
It's been an ongoing process since probably 1985. The initial dispersant use guidelines were, the first ones were signed in May of 1986, and it set up this Zone 1, Zone 2, Zone 3 concept, where Zone 1 would be a pre-approval zone where the agencies within the RRT, primarily the EPA and the state of Alaska, would say that the federal on-scene coordinator has authority to use dispersants without going through a formal approval process. His requirement is within, I think it's a 24-hour time period after the dispersants had been used, he would notify the state of Alaska and the Environmental Protection Agency within the regional response team. The Zone 2 area was designated as an area where dispersants may be applied but would need further consideration by the regional response team for whatever reasons, mostly resources at risk in the area, whether or not a dispersant or dispersed oil would have a severe impact on the resources in the area. And then the Zone 3, which would be that dispersants were not really recommended in that area due to primarily environmental sensitivity in the state, and that if an application was made, it would be considered by the regional response team. The original dispersant use guidelines were for Cook Inlet and were put into place for Cook Inlet. After 1986, we started work in setting up the dispersant use guidelines for Prince William Sound, and those were approved by the regional response team on March the 8th of 1989.
Was in situ burning discussed at that first RRT?
The in situ burning was discussed. We'd been, within the regional response team, we'd been discussing in situ burning for a number of years. It had been tested in the Tier 2 activities on the North Slope and had shown that it was certainly a favorable response technique for being able to respond to an oil spill. And until in the last year and a half or so, there's been increased discussions on the use of fireproof boom and using that in some configuration to contain oil and burn oil within a fireproof boom. And that was one of the, this spill, in my opinion, presented an opportunity to probably do just that. So it was discussed at the meeting, yes.
Have you ever done any in situ burning while you were on a strike team?
No, I never did.
During the first 24 hours, was there any request or desire expressed that the Coast Guard should take over the response from Exxon or Alyeska?
Not that I know of personally. Not within the first 24 hours. We received a letter from the state of Alaska on the second day that was dated the 24th that indicated that the RRT should closely examine the response it was, as it was going on.
Did you or the 17th District Commander Admiral Nelson ever get to the scene?
Not within the first 24 hours.
Does the ADC have to issue a burning permit for the in-situ burning?
In-state waters, yes.
So in the Sound, that's federal waters, I take it?
In the Sound is state waters.
Sound is state waters?
Yes, sir.
Was it ever requested from them?
Oh, yes, we discussed it in terms of the RRT concurred that in-situ burning would be a certainly a viable option and could be used. And I believe Bill Lamoureux was in Anchorage on the RRT conference and said, you know, the key factor on this is whether is the state issuance of a burning permit. And that's what we need to do. And Bill Lamoureux took it from there. And in terms of issuing the burning permit.
The state of Alaska is a member of the RRT,
I understand.
Did they concur with the advice that was being given to the on-scene coordinator, Coast Guard on-scene coordinator?
Yes, to the best of my knowledge, yes. We didn't hear any objections during the telephone conference.
After the RRT meeting, did you do anything further?
At 1500, we received a formal request for a burn permit from Alyeska. And there's about a 10 or 12 page. This whole document is a dispersant and in-situ burning checklist, of which two pages are the burning, in-situ burning application. And we received a formal request on that. We faxed that out to all of the members of the RRT indicating that we had discussed this before, and essentially we concur that it could be done if it's done in an area you know, where it wasn't the only restrictions we had put on it was that it did not interfere with other mechanical schemes that were going on. You don't want to light a fire next to a skimmer because it gets the operators nervous. So those type of operational choices, you know, we were saying, you know, get it in an area where you can set it up and actually, you know, conduct a burn.
Was a burn permit ever issued, do you know?
On the second day, yes, sir.
Okay. I have no further question.
Thank you, Mr. Kacharian. Captain Deppe?
We have no questions.
Mr. Howitt?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You stated that a burn permit was issued. Do you know what conditions were on that burn permit?
No, sir, I don't.
Okay, thank you. I have no other questions.
Dr. LaRush?
Mr. Chairman, Commander, just a couple quick ones. You spoke of the dispersant use checklist completed, which the RRT considered a request for dispersant use that you discussed at the 10 o'clock Friday RRT meeting.
Yes, sir.
Who who submitted this request?
It was submitted by Alieska, and it was submitted to, it was telefaxed to me, and there was some concern because I checked with Commander McCall to make sure that it had been submitted to the Federal On-Scene Coordinator, because that's the appropriate channel to do that. And he indicated that he had it in hand.
Was it submitted by Alieska on their own behalf?
I don't know that, sir. I don't know. All I know is, you know, the cover sheet was to me from, I think it was somebody from Alieska Pipeline Services. Okay.
The best of your knowledge, was Alieska aware of the RRT work regarding disbursement guidelines and pre-approvals as far back as 86? Were they involved in these RRT discussions?
In the discussions in 86, I'm not sure if Alieska was. They were in the approval of the Prince William Sound guidelines in October of 88. We held public meetings in Anchorage, Valdez, and Cordova, and Alieska participated in those public meetings in presenting the plan, explaining the dispersion use guidelines and how we would, you know, play this what-if game and how they could be used.
So what month was that in 88?
It was October, I think it was early October of 88.
So Alieska knew at least then, if not before, that dispersants would be allowed in Zone 1 in Prince William Sound.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. No more, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Colucciello?
I guess I need a clarification of the RRT performance. I understand you said they were primarily up in a policy or advisory role. Is that correct?
The RRT is an advisor to the Federal On-Scene Coordinator, yes.
But then you've said that the RRT kept receiving requests, so well, not maybe that's a not characterization, but they did get requests for use of dispersants, requests for use of burning. Now it seems like they are an approval-granting authority.
Under those two circumstances, they are.
So,
and that the reason for that, the dispersants is fairly straightforward. The Federal On-Scene Coordinator can authorize the use of dispersants as an operational tool with the concurrence of the representative of the EPA and the state representative of the RRT. So the RRT has to approve the application of dispersants.
Mm-hmm. But not all of the RRT, is that correct? Just the two members.
Mm-hmm. But an EPA, when they consider the use of dispersants, they receive input from normally the trustees of the natural resources, which would be the Department of Interior, Department of Commerce, and to a certain extent some of the state resource agencies.
Are they members of RRT also?
Yes.
So wondering how long this process takes. How many members are there on the RRT for this one in Alieska?
There are actually about 9 voting members.
Okay, there are voting and non-voting members then.
Yes.
Do you have to, so you only have to deal with those 9 whenever you get a request?
Yes. And it's their responsibility to gather information from the people that they need to gather it from.
Okay, do you have to get approval from all 9 for a certain action? Or,
no.
For instance, I mean, I can understand on a early Saturday morning, the difficulty, perhaps, of getting 9 people on the telephone at the same time.
With this RRT in Alieska, we've been through it a lot. We've been through it probably 6 or 7 times since November of 88. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's not a big deal to call them up at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Well, I can understand 2 o'clock in the morning may be very good, but say Sunday or Saturday afternoon, how do they all wear beepers, and how do you get in touch with them?
We try either the primary first. If we don't get the primary at their home or at their office, we try and get the alternate. And if we can't get the alternate, and it's a dispersant application, and we need the state of Alieska and the EPA, then we get the state of Alieska and the EPA.
Well, I got the impression you said that, for instance, you started calling at 6 o'clock that
yes.
morning and to set up a meeting at 10 o'clock.
Yes.
And then the meeting actually took place at 11:30. So I had to take it from that, it took about 5 hours or so to kind of gather everybody in a position where one could speak on a telephone conference.
Well, it gave everybody an opportunity to talk to the resource agencies that they need to talk to and be prepared to make a good informed decision. Yes.
Yeah. Then during the telephone conference, you present the issues that you have before you and the questions and perhaps even permit requests at that point. Was the decision made there while everybody is on the telephone, or do they have to go back and consult with, as you indicated, EPA does, go back and consult with other people, and then come back, have another conference, and then get the answer out?
In this particular circumstance, the decision was made at that time.
Mm-hmm. And what was your experience with how long it took to get decisions out of RRT? Can you express it in hours or whatever?
Depending on the urgency, and we can get a decision out of this RRT in as little as 2 hours.
Mm-hmm. Well, another question is, tell me a little bit about the composition of the strike teams. How many you have, and how many people in each team, and what equipment, and what is the goal of response time?
The National Strike Force has two teams currently. It's the Atlantic Area team is in Mobile, Alabama, and has 37 people, and the Pacific Area team is in San Francisco or Hamilton Air Force Base and has 28. Each maintains an inventory of 4 skimming barrier systems for high seas boom deployment, and they have I'd say 10 to 15 of these air deliverable anti-pollution transfer pumps, ADAPS, pumping systems that are available for assistance to the Federal Unseen Coordinator as he desires.
Are these on some kind of a 2-hour standby, or is there some? What is their readiness posture, and how many? Obviously, all people can't be ready all the time. So, what percentage are available, and what kind of response time?
The mission performance standards for the National Strike Force are within an hour. They have to have an individual en route or be able to start moving towards the scene of an incident. And I think within 4 to 6 hours have equipment staged and ready to be mobilized to a pollution incident.
Has the size of the resource changed over the years in the strike teams?
Yes, it has.
Well, what did it start as, and what did we have now?
Until 1987, there were 3 strike teams. There was one in Elizabeth City, North Carolina, the Atlantic Strike Team. It had approximately 28 people. And the Gulf Team was in Mobile, Alabama, had 27 or 28 people. The Atlantic Team had 38 people because they also had the National Dive Team at that time. And then the Pacific Strike Team had 28 people in 1987. And the Atlantic area strike teams were consolidated into one strike team in Mobile, Alabama, and had 37 people in summer of 1987.
I see. Thank you. No more questions.
Commander Waldron, I apologize. I did not intentionally skip you. Do you have any questions?
No questions.
That's why I skipped you. Mr. Army Trail?
Just one, Commander. And I may be stepping beyond our own boundaries here that we set for 24 hours, but it will only take 1 minute. At one point in time, hopefully within the 24 hours, but I guess not, was there at least some experimental burning attempted?
Not to my knowledge, sir.
Either during or after the first 24 hours? Not at all.
After the first 24 hours, yes, sir, there was.
If I may ask, with the consent of the chairman, could you just real briefly tell us the results of that, or just what the details were?
A test burn was conducted down near Goose Island in the, it was down roughly near Knoll's Head. And as it start, they got enough boom down there, a couple fishing boats that were willing to tow the boom behind it. And as I understand the process and the way it's been described is if you contain the oil in a fireproof boom and you keep the critical thickness of the oil between a tenth of an inch and a quarter of an inch, it will sustain a burn. And the theory behind it is if you get the burn started and you have oil continue to flow in, you can sustain a burn and keep it going for until the boom fails, essentially, or the fire goes out. And there's a process that was started in the late afternoon, about, say, 1700, 1800 or so, and a couple of attempts were made to get it lit, and it indeed started on fire and burned. The results were that somewhere between 15 and 20,000 gallons of oil were burned, and it left a 100-square-foot residue of thick tarry residue that had to be picked up by hand.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Danaher, do you have any questions?
I was just curious, how long did that that particular test burn take?
It took from the time of ignition until it was finished, it was about an hour and a half, 2 hours. It went into the darkness, and we got, one of the ships got confused and lost track of him. We thought it was a small boat on fire, so we responded as a SAR incident. It was Al Allen.
Thank you.
And then that residue was picked up?
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Commander, for your testimony. You're excused from the stand. I'm sorry.
Sure.
Captain Deppe.
Commander, in Exhibit 2 Delta, there's a meeting that was discussed on page 7. The second paragraph from the bottom. It says, at 1200, the captain of the port commenced an RRT teleconference to discuss use of dispersants and on-site burning of the oil. Decisions were not made at that time. Can you tell me what kind of decisions were being discussed and were not made, and what decisions were subsequently made after that teleconference?
The decisions in that particular conference were, one, in terms of the dispersants, was that the leading edge of the dispersant was going to be in a zone one, and that the, you know, we'd given the federal on-scene coordinator the nod that said, you know, it's in a pre-approval zone. If you think it's operationally proper to do it and continue it in the zone one, then that's your call. The in-situ burning part was primarily that the RRT concurred that in-situ burning could be a viable option, and that, you know, that if the state concurred and issued a burning permit, then we had concurrence, essentially.
So the decision was made that once the leading edge of the oil reached zone one, you could use dispersants, is that?
Yes, the OSC had the authority to allow the spiller to use dispersants in zone one. We did not make a decision at that time about the use of dispersants in zone two at the specific location of the ship.
Okay. And was there any concurrence needed from any other bodies on the board or on the committee there before dispersants could be used at that point, or the OSC could make that decision on its own?
The OSC could make that decision on its own, yes.
Thank you. That's all I have.
Mr. Howitt, follow up. Dr. Laresh, follow up. Commander Waldron, follow up. Thank you, Commander. You are excused.
Those were the three witnesses that we had identified for today. As I told you earlier, we have to be out of this room by noon. We were not able to start tomorrow's witnesses today, so I have a good news, bad news story. The good news is we're finished for today. The bad news is we will begin at 0730 tomorrow morning. We will go through the six witnesses, and we will be completed by tomorrow afternoon.
You're leaving here in this room. Do you want to make any dinner in this room? I don't know about the security in this room.
And that wraps up today's coverage. That wraps up today's coverage of the NTSB's inquiry into the wreck of the Exxon Valdez. Three witnesses were scheduled to be heard today, and they went through them rather rapidly. So we're concluding rather early. They're unable to begin tomorrow's slate of witnesses. And so with a very early start tomorrow, they'll be back for more Coast Guard. Today's testimony hinged largely on the so-called Battle of the Barge, the question of Alyeska's ability to respond in accordance with the contingency plan. And we heard more testimony just now from the Coast Guard's Regional Environmental Coordinator, Commander Dennis Rome, about the makeup of the Alaska Regional Response Team for oil spills and hazardous spills of other kinds. And some questioning that had to do with the ability of that body to make decisions quickly and respond quickly.
The overall point of the question was, he said that they've had enough emergencies that they've been able to respond pretty quickly, get the people together. There were some safety board members who said, look, you called a meeting. You started making telephone calls at 6 o'clock in the morning. You were hoping to get everybody together by 10. You didn't, in fact, get people together till 11:30. So. You know, what's the big, you're so sure that you're so fast to respond. Dennis Rome defended their ability to make decisions and things like that. Issue that came up that has not been covered a whole lot so far is this thing about in situ burning, that is to say, burning off the oil. And the technique that they try to use is to round up the oil with a boom and light it on fire. And from Rome's description, the test went pretty well, but it appears that when they actually tried to do it, it did not work particularly well. And that's an issue that has not received much discussion. Alyeska and Exxon have placed a lot of currency, made a lot of arguments about the use of dispersants. That did come up some today, but it appears that the safety board is as interested in this burning issue and why this never quite caught on as the companies are in the dispersant issue.
Absolutely, and I think that what finally happened, as I recall, after that test is that subsequent attempts to burn the oil were sort of thwarted by the weather, and particularly by that first big storm that occurred after the spill.
The other thing that happened is that they said that it's kind of a critical, I mean, you need between a tenth of an inch and a quarter of an inch thick oil sheen, and I guess if it gets much thicker, then it won't burn. If it gets a whole lot thinner, it won't burn, and that was another problem that they were having sustaining it, but there is a lot of discussion on that particular point. As Corey said, the other major issue we've dealt with this morning, or that the board has dealt with this morning, is the issue of the Alyeska barge, the barge that contained the oil spill response equipment, and how fast or how slowly it was able to respond to the oil spill and why it didn't respond as quickly as originally planned.
Now, one other thing that came up this morning was some questioning regarding the Alyeska's 12-person response team. Was formerly a contractor who maintained that team at the terminal, and it was decided, I believe, in 87 to, quote, absorb that response team into Alyeska's regular terminal personnel. There's been the implication that, in fact, that team was just kind of dissolved and that people on the regular oil spill personnel lists were designated, but that they no longer retained the cohesiveness of a response team. And though some of the questions were directed toward that, Bob Laresh, for instance, asked what the normal duties of those people were, and it turns out that at least Mr. Shire said that, well, they were line handlers. Apparently they were longshore people at the docks who were designated as the oil spill response team.
That was at the time that the oil spill occurred 2 weeks ago and 3 weeks ago in Valdez during the House Interior Subcommittee hearings. Alyeska had said basically their oil spill response people, oil spill was their main responsibility, but they're also maintenance men. They shoveled snow and they did other maintenance responsibilities. Those, Alyeska said, took were a second priority compared to their cleanup responsibilities. And Alyeska made the point there, and they made the point here too, that they train all of their entry-level people in some oil spill response. And so the way Alyeska presents it, they've got a large crew of people. They can draw on a large number of their people to get right to work in oil spill situations and say that those people are trained to do that. Some other one or two interesting points. Questions continued about these oil spill response plan, the one that says that Alyeska can pick up 200,000 barrels of oil. And there's been hours of discussion over the past couple weeks about this particular point in this plan. One interesting point that came out from Alyeska, Lauren Shire from Alyeska, talking about that plan, said really that when they came up with that, with their scenario of how they would pick up 200,000 barrels, they were assuming the best day, the longest day of the year, and some of the best weather Valdez has ever has. They were figuring relatively calm seas, good weather, long, long days. And in fact, when reality struck, they were faced with something very, very different. And he said they were worried about the safety of their people and so could not respond as quickly as you know, their optimistic projections had said that they could.
It was, too, the issue of the speed. In the contingency plan, they said that they could get their response barge out to a location, a spill as much as 30 miles away from the terminal in 3 to 5 hours, when, in fact, that would have postulated a speed of 10 knots for this barge fully loaded. And Mr. Shire admitted that he thought that that was a very, very optimistic estimate of what kind of speed this barge could make. In fact, I believe it took something close to 15 hours to get the barge on scene.
So that pretty much wraps it up today. Tomorrow we will be hearing from a number of Coast Guard officials. As a matter of fact, the entire list is Coast Guard people. Commander Stephen McCall, the man who is the port supervisor, the port commander in Valdez, the man who was really at the center of the action in the very early day, in the very early hours of the spill. Also, Lieutenant James Rice, who's an operations officer, Bruce Moores, who is a radio man, Donald Aldrich, an electronics technician, and Lieutenant Commander Donald Opdahl, and Paul Manette, Commander Paul Manette. So tomorrow is Coast Guard Day at the National Transportation Safety Board hearings here at the Captain Cook in Anchorage. And as we heard, they will be starting at 7:30 in the morning.
Okay, this concludes today's coverage of the National Transportation Safety Board's Anchorage hearings under the wreck of the Exxon Valdez. Join us tomorrow when those hearings resume. You heard it at 7:30 a.m. I'm Corey Flintoff here with Bruce Melzer. Our engineer is Bill Glynn, and our producer is Bruce Melzer. Coverage of the NTSB hearings is brought to you by KSKA Anchorage and APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.